This is VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
The coronavirus health crisis has interfered with almost every part of daily human life, including what we eat. Nearly a year into social distancing, many people are enjoying foods long forgotten or once rejected for taste, feel, or smell. Some have added healthful food to their diets to strengthen the body's natural defenses. Home cooking activity is up everywhere as a result of restrictions on restaurants and other food shops. People are increasingly exploring new food experiences in their own kitchens.
Mary Ferguson is a 31-year-old woman living in Brooklyn, New York. She got COVID-19 last year and recovered. But the disease damaged her sense of taste and smell for months. Many of her favorite foods no longer satisfied her. Ferguson can again sense sweetness, saltiness, and spiciness, although many foods still seem to lack a strong taste, but not pears. The fruit was not part of her pre-COVID diet. "I knew what a bad, unripe pear tasted like, but not a good one," she said. Thanks to a gift from a friend, she pushed herself to find a good example. It was one of the first foods she could truly taste again. "I'm a full convert," Ferguson said. "I'll never forget biting into a juicy red pear."
Fruits are simple pleasures, but fermented foods have also become popular. Fermented foods last a long time in the refrigerator, which is a help if you go food shopping less often than before. Anastasia Sharova, a chef in Stuttgart, Germany, runs HappyBellyFish.com. The company is an online cooking school that works on healthy food. It added fermentation classes in late 2019. Then the coronavirus crisis hit. Suddenly, interest in making kimchi and sauerkraut, two kinds of fermented cabbage, and miso, fermented soybean, increased sharply. Earlier, kombucha, a fermented tea, had helped popularize home fermented foods. "Health became number one for many last year," Sharova said. She added that being at home caused many to make cooking discoveries. She said fermenting things is like a community activity done by families or in online classes. 30-year-old Alicia Harper also has discovered fermented foods. She is a nutritionist in New York City. She did not like the strong tastes and smells of fermented foods at first. "Since trying them again recently, my opinion has completely changed. I have now grown to love the taste and smell," she said. Anne Alderete of Los Angeles, California, is now enjoying natto. Made of fermented soybeans, natto is popular in Japan, but considered too unusual by many people. I've smelled it many times since I'm half Japanese and lived in Tokyo after college for 7 years, the 47-year-old said. But she never liked to eat natto before COVID-19. I feel somewhat virtuous when I eat natto because the health benefits are many. But it's also because it's brought me closer to my roots, Alderete said.
Some experts think that changes in the way we eat also come from having more time to consider information about how food comes to our tables. Ryan Andrews is a dietitian who wrote a book on plant-based foods. Ryan is also an advisor for Precision Nutrition, which trains nutrition coaches. He said many people are learning painful truths about the food system. Andrews said people have learned about the unsafe working conditions in meat packing plants, the unfair wages of farm laborers. He added that other problems include disease related to diet, cruelty to farm animals, and the cost of industrialized agriculture. At the same time, the research company Semrush has studied Google searches related to changing food interests during the COVID-19 crisis. Their findings suggest comfort food and some unusual combinations are still on people's minds. The company found a 17% increase in searches for peanuts and Coke in December when compared to December 2019. It found a 33% rise for prosciutto and melon. And it found a 95% jump in searches for bacon and jam.
A service called Woodspoon uses technology to connect people cooking at home with people willing to pay for a home-cooked meal. The company is based in New York. Its chief, Oren Saar, spoke to the Associated Press. He suggested that before the health crisis, there was a strong interest in healthy, less processed foods. Afterwards, orders for breads, pasta, and fatty meats increased. In challenging times like this, diners are looking for authentic, homemade food, Saar said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.,
and I'm Ashley Thompson.
American scientists say they have developed a way to grow wood material in a laboratory. The method could create different wood products indoors in a single process, greatly cutting the cost of production and reducing damage to the world's forests. Researchers from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology demonstrated a proof of concept by growing wood-like structures from cells taken from the leaves of a flowering plant. The results were recently reported in a study appearing in the Journal of Cleaner Production. The lead researcher on the project was Luis Fernando Velasquez Garcia, a scientist in MIT's Microsystems Technology Laboratories. He told MIT News the process is still in early development. But if it can be perfected, it could simplify and speed up the production of wood products. The way we get these materials hasn't changed in centuries and is very inefficient, Velasquez Garcia said. For example, the current process for making a wooden table can take many years. First, a tree has to grow. Then it must be cut down, transported, processed, etc. Velasquez Garcia says lab-grown wood could combine all those steps into one. If you want a table, then you should just grow a table, he said. The process is similar in some ways to lab-produced meat, which is grown from live animal cells. But in the wood experiment, the MIT team collected live cells from the leaves of a zinnia plant. The plant cells were then cultured and kept in an environment designed to activate and support growth. Plant cells are similar to stem cells in the sense that they can become anything if they are induced to, Velasquez Garcia said. The experiment was carried out indoors, without soil or sunlight. During the process, the researchers used a mixture of two plant hormones that helped the cells grow a thick, strong, wood-like structure. With further development, the researchers say they could use the same process to grow wood in specific shapes, such as a table or chair. Ashley Beckwith is a doctoral student in mechanical engineering at MIT who led the research. She told MIT News she got the idea for the project while spending time on a farm. She said she wondered whether some of the inefficiencies present in agriculture could be improved through laboratory methods. I wanted to find a more efficient way to use land and resources so that we could let more arable areas remain wild, Beckwith said. She says the experiment demonstrated that growing plant tissue in a lab could also have a big effect in agriculture. Like with wood production, the process could reduce the time and effort related to traditional agriculture methods. It could also remove difficulties linked to weather and seasonality in farming, Beckwith said. Such a lab-based farming method promises to improve yields while reducing plant waste and competition for arable land, the research study states. David Stern is a plant biologist and president of the Boyce Thompson Institute. He was not involved in the study. He told MIT News one big question is whether the technology can be effectively scaled and remain economically competitive. Stern added that scaling up the method would require major financial and intellectual investments. And he said new issues would arise when bringing parts of forestry and agriculture into the lab. Agriculture uses the sun's energy through photosynthesis and natural rainfall. It does not require buildings, heat, or artificial light, Stern said. Velasquez Garcia said his team will be working to improve the method especially to learn how to better control the final materials that are produced. And the researchers also want to carry out new experiments to see whether the same results can be reached with other kinds of plants. I'm Brian Lynn.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. We continue the story of the administration of Herbert Hoover, and we talk about the election of 1932.
President Herbert Hoover worked hard to rescue the American economy following the crash of the stock market. It happened in October of 1929. Within a month, Hoover called the nation's business leaders to the White House. "Don't lower wages," the president told them. Hoover called on the bankers at the Federal Reserve to make it easier for businesses to borrow money. He tried to provide funds to help farmers get fair prices for their crops. He pushed Congress to lower personal taxes. And above all, the president urged Americans not to lose hope in their economy or in themselves.
But the economy was in ruins, falling faster with each passing day of the crisis that grew into the Great Depression. The value of stocks had collapsed. Millions of workers lost their jobs. The level of industrial production in the country was less than half of what it had been before the stock market crash. Hoover's efforts were not enough to stop the growing crisis. In ever greater numbers, people called on the president to increase federal spending and provide jobs for people out of work. But the president was a conservative Republican. He did not think it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide relief for poor Americans. And he thought it was wrong to increase spending above the amount of money that the government received in taxes.
The situation seemed out of control. The nation's government and business leaders appeared to have no idea how to save the dollar and put people back to work. Hoover was willing to take steps like spending government money to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizer, but he was not willing to give wheat to unemployed workers who were hungry. He created an emergency committee to study the unemployment problem, but he would not launch government programs to create jobs. Hoover called on Americans to help their friends in need. But he resisted calls to spend federal funds for major relief programs to help the millions of Americans facing disaster.
Leaders of the Democratic Party made the most of the situation. They accused the president of not caring about the common man. They said Hoover was willing to spend money to feed starving cattle for businessmen, but not willing to feed poor children. Hoover tried to show the nation that he was dealing with the crisis. He worked with Congress to try to save the banks and to keep the dollar tied to the value of gold. He tried hard to balance the federal budget. And he told Americans that it was not the responsibility of the national government to solve all their problems.
Late in 1931, President Hoover appointed a new committee on unemployment. He named Walter Gifford to head this committee. Gifford was chief of a big company, American Telephone and Telegraph. But Gifford did Hoover more harm than good. When he appeared before Congress, Gifford was unable to defend Hoover's position that relief was the responsibility of local governments and private giving. He admitted that he did not know how many people were out of work. He did not know how many of them needed help, or how much help they needed, or how much money local governments could raise.
The situation grew worse. Some Americans began to completely lose faith in their government. They looked to groups with extreme political ideas to provide answers. Some Americans joined the Communist Party. Others helped elect state leaders with extreme political ideas. And in growing numbers, people began to turn to hatred and violence. However, most Americans remained loyal to traditional values, even as conditions grew steadily worse. They looked ahead to 1932, when they would have a chance to vote for a new president.
Leaders of the Democratic Party felt they had an excellent chance to capture the White House in the election, and their hopes increased when the Republicans renominated President Hoover and Vice President Charles Curtis in the summer of 1932. For this reason, competition was fierce for the Democratic presidential nomination. The top candidate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the governor of New York State. Roosevelt had been re-elected to that office by a large majority just 2 years earlier. He came from a rich and famous family, but he was seen as a friend of the common man. Roosevelt was conservative in his economic thinking, but he was a progressive in his opinion that government should be active in helping people. Roosevelt had suffered from polio and could not walk. He used a wheelchair, although it was rarely shown in news pictures.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's two main opponents were Al Smith and John Garner. Smith had been the governor of New York before Roosevelt. Garner, a Texan, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Together, they hoped to block Roosevelt's nomination, and they succeeded the first three times that delegates voted at the Democratic nominating convention in Chicago. Roosevelt's chief political advisor, James Farley, worked hard to find Roosevelt the votes he needed at the convention. Finally, Farley found a solution. He made a deal with supporters of John Garner. Roosevelt would make Garner the vice presidential nominee if Garner's forces voted to make Roosevelt the presidential nominee. Garner agreed. And on the next vote, the Democratic delegates nominated Franklin Roosevelt to be their presidential candidate. Al Smith was so angry about the deal that he left Chicago without congratulating Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to show the nation that he was the kind of man to take action, that he had more imagination than Hoover. So he broke tradition and flew to Chicago. It was the first time a candidate had ever appeared at a convention to accept a nomination. And Roosevelt told the cheering crowd that together they would defeat Hoover.
The main issue in the campaign of 1932 was the economy. President Hoover defended his policies. Roosevelt and the Democrats attacked the administration for not taking enough action. Roosevelt knew that most Americans were unhappy with the Hoover administration. So his plan during the campaign was to let Hoover defeat himself. He avoided saying anything that might make groups of voters think he was too extreme. But Roosevelt did make clear that he would move the federal government into action to help people suffering from the economic crisis. He said he was for a balanced federal budget, but he also said the government must be willing to spend extra money to prevent people from starving.
Americans liked what they heard from Franklin Roosevelt. He seemed strong. He enjoyed life. And Roosevelt seemed willing to try new ideas, to experiment with government. Hoover attacked Roosevelt bitterly during the campaign. He warned that Roosevelt and the Democrats would destroy the American system. But Americans were tired of Hoover. They thought he was too serious, too afraid of change, too friendly with business leaders instead of the working man. Most of all, they blamed Hoover for the hard times of the Depression. On Election Day, Americans voted in huge numbers for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. Roosevelt won 42 of the 48 states at that time. The Democrats also gained a large majority in both houses of Congress.
The election ended 12 years of Republican rule in the White House. It also marked the passing of a long conservative period in American political life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would become one of the strongest and most progressive presidents in the nation's history. He would serve longer than any other president, changing the face of America's political and economic systems.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.